This is the case of little, and we also have Desert Eagle, but we have the same attorneys in each case, do we? And what I would also like to mention, there was some suggestion that there should be recusals in this case because of matters pending before the judicial conference, and there will be no recusals from this panel, but if any matters come up in the judicial conference that relate to, I mean, the judicial council that relate to the matters that were referred to, there will be recusals there, but not here. With that, I call the first case, and that is Little and Desert Eagle. We're calling them both, I guess. And with that, Mr. Camara, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court. My name is Kiwi Camara, and I'm joined at council table by my colleague Demetrius Anapakos and our co-counsel, David Warden of Yetter and Warden. I'd like to begin with the client case. The district court held as a matter of law that there is no difference between the market value of a properly licensed public accountant and an accountant who had no Texas license at all and whose only application for a Texas license was denied, John Hudson, or an accounting firm that was statutorily ineligible for a Texas license, that had procured its license by fraud in every year from 1984 to 1999, and that held that license subject to mandatory revocation at any time should the state board have learned the truth. The easiest way to see that there is a difference between the market value of those different kinds of services is to imagine the negotiation that would have taken place had KPMG told our clients the truth. KPMG would have introduced John Hudson, said he was the head of their investment company audit practice, at the top of his profession, had done engagements X, Y, and Z, much like the potential engagement, but then KPMG would have gone on. They would have said that John Hudson lacks a license, so that every time he practices accounting or auditing in Texas, he is committing a crime. They would have informed their clients that had they submitted Mr. Hudson's reports to a third party, they might be perpetrating a fraud or aiding and abetting a crime. And they would have explained that John Hudson's lack of a license put KPMG in the position of being ineligible for a license. They would have explained that KPMG could have solved the problem by firing John Hudson or transferring him to New York, but that because Hudson was a rainmaker, they didn't want to rock the boat, and so they simply covered up John Hudson's existence from 1984 to 1999, attempting to sneak him in 1986, getting detected by the state board, and then again deciding to cover it up. Finally, in 1992, lying to the state board by claiming that Mr. Hudson was an out-of-state partner, when in fact he had been a partner in Texas since 1984, in Mr. Hudson's single license application, an application that in 1993 was denied, and then again simply omitting Mr. Hudson from the list of partners practicing in Texas all the way to 1999. We submit that it is at least plausible that if KPMG had given that pitch to our clients, they would have walked out the door and hired one of KPMG's competitors instead, like Mr. Little at Little Roberts & Company. There is no question that we have pled the story that I've just described. The only question is whether that pleading states a legally cognizable claim for damages. And that question was resolved by this court in Coughlin, where the court held that benefit of the bargain damages and out-of-pocket damages are neither novel nor exotic, where the plaintiff pleads that the value...
You got the benefit of your bargain, it seems to me.
We think not, Your Honor.
Well, I know, but you got the benefit of a licensed, in other words, you got the benefit of a licensed accounting firm, and that is that the entire public knew, thought that it was a licensed accounting firm. That's what you paid for, and that's essentially what you got.
Well, the measure of benefit of the bargain or out-of-pocket damages is at the time the services...
What part of the big bargain did you not get the benefit of?
We did not get the benefit of a properly licensed public accountant who could have commanded higher rates.
Okay, and how does that relate? No, wait a minute. We have to talk about two different situations here: the competitive injury and the customer injury.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Now, referring to the competitive injury, The benefit of the bargain is really the argument that you focus on with respect to the customer injury, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the customer injury is what? Where is the injury in this case?
The injury lies in the fact that the customers, our clients, paid fees to KPMG for a service which was other than the service that KPMG delivered. And had KPMG told them about that difference, the lack of Hudson's...
Now, had they told them? Why does that end into the injury? Where is the injury?
The injury is the difference in value between what was delivered and what was promised.
And what was the difference in the value, given the fact that they had a license, even if it were improper, and the public knew they had a license, and all their customers assumed they had a license, and... Where is the injury?
Well, of course.
Where is the injury to the competitor?
To the competitor?
To the customer.
To the client, of course. As to Mr. Hudson, he had no license at all.
That's one out of 700, of course.
That's right.
One out of 700.
But we, two of our named plaintiffs are clients of Mr. Hudson and are suing for fees paid for work performed by Mr. Hudson. So at least as to that subgroup of plaintiffs, Mr. Hudson's lack of a license doesn't raise the concerns in the question. As to KPMG...
As I understand, you're saying we're not complaining about the quality of the service we got.
Correct. And I'd like to make a distinction between consequential damages, tort damages for accounting malpractice and whatnot, and the kinds of damages that we seek in this case, contract-style damages for the difference in value. It's not our position that there are no consequential damages. Indeed, the limited partners in one of our plaintiffs brought an accounting malpractice claim against KPMG and got an eight-figure settlement. But with respect to the contract claims, the difference in value is assessed at the time the services were provided. It's just as though you'd been sold a knockoff Rolex.
Well, is the injury? In other words, they got what they bargained for. They bargained for a licensed accounting firm. The accounting firm was licensed. The public knew it. The customer never was injured. Where is the injury?
The injury is in the difference in value, and I see that this point is not gaining traction, so let me see if I can sell it through a hypothetical. The facts in this Court's Coughlin decision, for instance, the fiberglass boat with the wood coated by fiberglass, it wouldn't matter in that case if no one detected the fact that inside all that fiberglass there was a piece of wood, nor would it matter whether or not the boat had yet sunk, nor would it matter whether the plaintiff had yet tried to sell the boat. At the time the boat was delivered, it was something other than what was promised, and the rates the market would have commanded for that boat, even though no one yet knew that it was wrong, had the fact of the wood inside the fiberglass been disclosed, would have been less than the rates that would have been commanded by an all-fiberglass boat.
That's quite a different case in the sense that you have a physical object there that has value to it. Here you had accounting services, a professional service, about the quality of which you are not complaining. Nobody suffered any tangible or concrete injury as a result of this offense. Where is the concreteness of your injury?
With respect, Your Honor, we are alleging that there are defects in the quality of the services, not with whether the accounting was correct, but, for instance, generally accepted auditing standards require that accountants comply with all of the professional standards of their profession. They require adequate supervision, and, of course, Mr. Hudson, as someone engaged in a crime, every time he practiced accounting was not an adequate supervisor. Moreover, the testimony of...
Was it a crime?
It was a crime.
Is it a criminal statute that he violated, or was it administrative regulation that said that he had to be licensed in Texas? I mean, what was the crime, the statute, the criminal crime that he committed?
Practicing accounting in Texas without a license is a Class B misdemeanor in Texas.
Was he ever charged?
No, Your Honor.
Was any action ever taken against the accounting firm for this violation?
No, Your Honor, but I should point out that by the time all these facts came to light, KPMG had done a good cover-up. We discovered these facts in the course of the accounting malpractice litigation. described earlier, and our clients in that case, also our clients in this case, decided to sue. But that was well after 1999, when all the licenses at issue had expired. The licenses expire every year in the beginning of the period and every other year in the later part of the period. So by the time that the facts came to light, the State Board really had nothing to do. There were no KPMG licenses that were polluted by Hudson's presence, so on and so forth. And that said,
the statute today, or the regulation today, does provide for someone like him to be part of the law, part of the accounting firm?
No, Your Honor. No statute permits an unlicensed accountant to practice accounting in Texas. The statute today does allow KPMG to have partners, it doesn't require KPMG to identify every partner in Texas with their Texas license number. So that requirement as to KPMG is not present, but the requirement as to Hudson is present all throughout the 84 to 99 period and even to the present day.
You know, in terms of just the person on the street, aren't this just a case of you were cheated, but there's no injury?
If
someone is cheated and there is no injury, is there a cause of action?
The same could be said of the person who sold the very good knockoff Rolex that no one notices. That person's been cheated, but if no one notices ever and it tells time properly.
Yeah, you still got the physical property. You paid a lot of money for something that's cheap.
Well, there is no case which draws the distinction suggested by the question between physical property and a service. For example, if a lawyer lied about his licensure and presented a case in court, as the court is aware in the criminal context, that's been held to be a major problem. And certainly it would be a strange rule of law for lies about services not to be actionable, whereas lies about property are actionable. The question under the cases is not whether there is a physical property. The question is whether there's a difference in market value of what was delivered as opposed to what was promised.
What is your evidence of that difference in market value?
Well, of course, this case was dismissed at the pleading stage before we had any opportunity to offer evidence. That said, we have offered the expert testimony of a former partner of KPMG during the relevant time period, the testimony of Wanda Lorenz, a former member of the Texas State Board of Public Accountancy, and we've offered the pleadings, 89-page pleadings in both cases, drafted in great detail, that set out the claim that there is a difference in value, a difference in market value, between proper licensure and improper licensure. And we submit, as this Court knows, the test is plausibility. We submit that it is plausible that our clients would have walked away had KPMG explained the problems with its license. If I could turn briefly to the competitor case. In the competitor case, the contention is that our damages are speculative because I think we have failed to identify particular items of business over which our clients competed with KPMG. But that requirement is found nowhere in the law. As the Court knows, in Lujan, the Supreme Court explained that injury is satisfied by pleading the invasion of a legally protected interest, so that if you satisfy all of the elements under the common law for a cause of action, you've succeeded in pleading injury. Here, in Bradford versus Vento, the Texas courts have held that with respect to a tortious interference claim, one need not plead specific items of business. It's sufficient to plead the class of customers over which the competition was based. This court in Pacific Gas has considered what level of pleading is adequate to plead injury in a competition case and held that, quote, decline in business, end quote, was adequate language in a complaint. This precise issue was addressed by the Eastern District in Star Tobacco versus Derelict, where the Court considered precisely the argument whether or not one must identify specific items of business and held that doing so is unnecessary. So we believe we've satisfied the plausibility requirement with respect to the competitor case and with respect to the client case.
With respect to the competitor case, I mean, there are a lot of ifs about that. In other words, if it had been known to the Texas Public Accounting, TCPA, whatever it's call?
State Board.
And if it had taken a certain action, and if there had been no correction of that action, and if people had left the firm, I mean, there are just too many ifs, aren't there, before you reach the conclusion of whether you identify any particular person who would have had the benefit of the loss of business of the accounting firm.
I think not, Your Honor. If you look at the text of the statute, it is crystal clear that the license of an accountant who does not, of an accounting firm that does not satisfy every requirement shall be revoked. That appears directly after a may revoke provision. And if we had any doubt about the meaning of the statute, that doubt is taken away by the deposition testimony of the executive director of the State Board, who has testified that KPMG should not have held a license from 1984 until 1999. With respect to all of the things...
That would be if they had not corrected the problem that they had. They could have cured the problem.
Certainly. Certainly, Your Honor.
They could have cured it momentarily, couldn't they?
Yes, they could have fired Mr. Hudson or transferred him to New York. But that is true.
And doesn't your damage model depend upon the fact that they would not have cured it?
No, Your Honor. We are suing over KPMG's unauthorized practice with a license procured by fraud, so on and so forth, during the class period. The fact that KPMG could have chosen to behave lawfully instead of in the way in which it actually behaved does not make our claim for damages speculative. That would be true in every case. The defendant typically could have behaved lawfully, and had the defendant behaved lawfully, the damages might have disappeared. But that, of course, is no defense. That's the essential part of the claim.
All right.
If we turn to exclusive jurisdiction, this, I think, is KPMG's principal position. Here, I think KPMG has simply invoked the wrong doctrine. Their contention is not that cases
That's
like...
Do you need a little more time? I mean, this is a complicated case, and do you need a little more time?
I wouldn't mind more time, Your Honor.
Okay, why don't we give each side just two more minutes?
Okay. If we look at exclusive jurisdiction, KPMG's contention is not that the Sherman Act cases should be resolved by the State Board. It is not that RICO cases should be somehow heard by non-lawyers on the State Board. It is rather that there is a predicate question with respect to our causes of action that they contend is within the special competence of the State Board, the question of the validity of the licenses. But the doctrine that governs referrals to agencies with respect to predicate questions is primary jurisdiction, not exclusive jurisdiction, as this Court explained in its decisions in Penny and Northwinds. In the Court below, we specified in our response to the motions to dismiss this distinction, and KPMG declined to urge primary jurisdiction on the Court. KPMG has made the same strategic call in this Court. So the fact that the question here is a predicate one and not a question with respect to the entire case means that the application of the exclusive jurisdiction doctrine is inappropriate. If we turn to the substantive causes of action, first I want to point out Judge Garwood's recent opinion in the Orth Alliance case, which refers to the licensing statute for dentists in Texas and holds that a contract that requires a person who is not licensed to practice dentistry to do an act which the statute defines as the practice of dentistry is an illegal contract. That case, I think, is squarely on point with respect to our illegal contract and hence unjust enrichment quantum merit claim.
But that case never gets to the remedy for that breach, though, does it?
That's correct, Your Honor. It merely holds that the contract was illegal. And if we focus on the remedy...
I guess that's not conceded here by any means, but that the contract itself, between it and its clients, was illegal. But it is a matter of injury and damages that flow from that illegal contract.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And what I would urge, what KPMG is asking for in this case is a special rule of law with respect to damages. They claim that when the plaintiff alleges a difference in value caused by a defect in the licensing status of the person performing the service, then as a matter of law, there can be no difference in market value. There's nothing that supports that kind of legal rule. The cases refer to the cases that have rejected claims against unlicensed parties refer to a failure to plead the difference in value.
I don't doubt. I mean, it seems plausible to me that if you sit down and you're going to negotiate an accounting firm to represent you, and one has a license and one doesn't have a license, the one who doesn't have a license is going to demand a much lower price. And I understand your argument that if you were sitting down today, knowing what you know today with them, you would be in a different bargaining position than you were then. But then that itself does not translate ultimately into an injury that you have suffered. That's the problem that I would have with that.
Well, Your Honor,
and that's, I guess, what we've discussed about, but you can surely respond to what I've said.
In one brief sentence, the injury is in the fees we paid. We would not have paid those fees absent the misrepresentation. The injury was complete at the time the fees were paid and the services delivered, and the value of those services is measured not by what happened later, which in some instances was bad, remember our malpractice action, but by what was delivered at the time of the fee payment and the contract. I thank the Court for its time.
Yes, sir. Thank you. You've saved some time for rebuttal, Mr.
Yes,
Kavanaugh. Mr. Villa, we'll hear from you next. Mr. Villa, I guess. Is it Villa?
It's Villa, Your Honor. Thank you. John Villa for Williams & Connolly, and I represent KPMG and its former partners, who are the appellees and cross-appellants. With me at council table is Mr. Van Kirk. Before I go through the argument that I had planned, let me respond to some of the questions that the Court placed before my opposing counsel. First of all, the distinction between the Rolex and the services, or the distinction between the boat that had a different bottom and the services. At some point, that Rolex is going to be sold. And when it is sold, the person who sees it will say, it's not a $10,000 Rolex, it's a $20 knockoff. So somebody is going to be hurt by that. The same thing is true of the boat. There's a difference in the value of the boat with a strong bottom and with a weak bottom. Now here, you ask yourself, is there any difference in services? Well, the proof, as they say, in the pudding is in the tasting. Have they said that there is one out of the probably 15,000 clients who has taken any remedial action to correct the services? The answer is not 1 cent. The only cent that has been spent is presumably on these lawyers. So there is no difference in the...
I thought they said that someone had sued for the quality of services that were provided and that they got an eight-figure judgment.
There was a prior litigation involving these same lawyers arising out of some... I believe they sued an investment company that had been involved in a fraud, and they named KPMG as well. So there's prior litigation. And indeed, we are not talking, as the Court I think is clearly aware, of cases involving malpractice. If there's a case involving malpractice, they're free to sue whether all the individual accountants were licensed or not. We're not dealing with a malpractice case. They've expressly forsworn it, and the district court has pointed that out to them. This is not a malpractice case. So if there is a malpractice case, we're not touching it here. We're talking about a case that is solely predicated on the issue of whether or not one out of hundreds of accountants was licensed.
Well, his argument is obviously that at the time that he was bargaining with you, you charged him for the services of a licensed firm, he got the services of an unlicensed firm, and that he's got economists that can tell you the difference in the market price between the two, and that he paid for something that he did not get, and that is his injury, and the injury occurred at the time the bargain was made.
What he's actually saying is a little, he kind of moves between arguments. He thinks he got a licensed firm, and he did get a licensed firm, but he says it wasn't properly licensed.
That's the other twist, yeah.
It wasn't properly licensed, and therefore, he's kind of jumped over into the unlicensed category and said, I want to start invoking the issues about unlicensed providers of services without pointing out to you, as the district court, when they tried it in the district court said, wait a second, those cases you're citing are involving unlicensed providers of services. Nobody disputes they were licensed. Your argument is that they were not, quote, properly licensed. And so I ask, gee, why don't you cite the cases involving people who are licensed but not...
He would say they were illegally licensed.
Well, Your Honor,
there's a difference between improper and illegal, but...
Well, I think he actually uses the word properly licensed time and again, and that's what the district court said. But whether it's illegally licensed or improperly licensed, the question is, why don't they invoke a rule? How about the jurisprudence about people who are licensed but not legally licensed, or licensed and not properly licensed? And the reason they don't invoke that jurisprudence is that it doesn't exist. Yeah. It just doesn't exist. I mean, if we started down that path, somebody could say, well, Mr. Villa walked out of a CLE after 2 hours and took a telephone call. He didn't get all 3 hours. And then they get somebody from the bar that says, well, gee, he wasn't entitled to a license for the next year. Or better yet, I cheated on my senior thesis. It was really 14 pages. It should have been 15, and I shouldn't have graduated from Michigan Law School. We're starting to go through this alternative reality for which there is no jurisprudential base. Clever indeed.
Has there been any challenge to any of the work or the audits done by the accounting firm because it was not properly licensed, and somehow somebody say that audit or that work was invalid or not reliable and try to overturn some previous contract or agreement because it was based on an improperly done audit or done by an improperly licensed?
There is one lawsuit but that's over with. But the people involved in this case are people who don't have that claim. They've expressly given up that claim because there's no way, first of all, they'd be barred by statute of limitations, and there's no way there would be any commonality between...
This one case was settled. There was no legal conclusion about liability in that one way or the other, or was it...
That's my understanding, Your Honor. So we are dealing with, and we are not trying to foreclose issues of accounting malpractice. We are dealing solely with the issue of licensure, and not even an unlicensed. The one thing we have to remember, because it's so easy to slip over, we're trying to find a pigeonhole to put this into, and no pigeonhole exists. And so we keep thinking, well, it's an unlicensed, KPMG was unlicensed. It wasn't. It was licensed.
What it really comes down to, though, is injury. Not whether they're licensed or unlicensed so much here as to whether they can demonstrate any kind of plausible injury that resulted from an improper license.
And that's right. And that's exactly what the district court said. They got it's almost the first question you ask. They got legitimate accounting services from a licensed Texas accounting firm, and you've forsworn making any remedial action. I mean, the notion of remedial action would be the antithesis of what a group of plaintiffs would want. Can you imagine a bunch of companies coming in and saying, I think all of our prior tax or audit advice is subject to question? They would never do that. Never. It would make no sense. They're happy with their tax and audit advice. They would never, and that's why they had to give up on that argument. They thought about it after the first pleading.
Well, what does that do? What effect does that have where it is against one's self-interest? I mean, to claim an injury.
Your Honor, there's nobody claiming injury. Why ever they might claim injury or could claim injury, nobody is claiming injury. There is no evidence before this record, not one iota, that anybody was injured to the extent of one penny, that they took any action. They say, well, two of our clients dealt with Hudson. They're not bringing case on behalf of two clients. They've specifically said in district court that they're bringing it on behalf of all KPMG clients for a 15-year period in Texas. All these clients from 1984 to 1989, that's the people that they're bringing.
But it seems to me that the ordinary way, a person ordinarily look at this, is that they were done a wrong. And are you just saying that this is a wrong for which there is no remedy because there is no injury?
Your Honor, they weren't done a wrong because we have to remember, they didn't hire Mr. Hudson with and the first word out of his mouth was, imagine the following. Imagine. That's it. 99.9% of the people here had no dealings with Mr. Hudson. They didn't know Mr. Hudson. They wanted KPMG. They got KPMG. They wanted KPMG licensed. KPMG was licensed. This imaginary discussion might have happened with one person, and if they did, let them sue on behalf of that one person, but they can't even bring that up. That is not what happened here. They contracted with KPMG, just like somebody would contract with Williams and Connolly or with FedEx. They contracted with KPMG for the delivery of a service. They got the delivery of a service. If there is a rule that says we can now impugn the value of services based upon some notion that we're going to go back in time and replay history, that everything is opened up. Indeed, there is the reason they cannot assert a case is because it doesn't exist. The closest they can come is the totally unlicensed provider of services.
But there was a misrepresentation.
Pardon?
There was a misrepresentation in your dealings with them.
Your Honor.
And that is, I mean, you were representing yourself to be a properly licensed law firm, I mean, an accounting firm, and you were not.
Your Honor, I believe the only representation, to the extent that it's there, is that they were licensed, and they were indeed licensed. There was no statement, we are licensed and we don't know that there's any issue with any one of our 600 accountants. So I don't believe...
Well, I mean, you did know that. I mean, according to the complaint, at least. I mean, you knew you were hiding, according to the allegations, you were hiding the fact that he was unlicensed.
Your Honor, we can't dispute an allegation in the complaint. The point that I'm making here is that the representation that's being made to a potential client is that we're KPMG and we're licensed. And as the district court found after thinking about it, that's true. We are licensed. They are licensed. We're not saying, nobody is ever saying, and nobody ever would, that the license we hold would never be subject to question. Nobody says that. What you're saying is, I'm licensed today. And I am licensed today. And so is KPMG licensed today. The district court got it exactly right on the issue of licensure. There is no standard, there is no jurisprudence when you think about it, where people can go back and replay history and say, well, I'm going to devalue what you got, even though you're not going to take any action to correct it. You feel no compunction to do that, and nobody ever has taken any action. We're going to go back and say, we're going to restrike the bargain in the imaginary conversation that happened over the table, 99.99% of which the clients have no idea who Mr. Hudson is.
Now, the district court ruled in your favor with regard to the competitors on what, on lack of standing under Article 3 and as to the customers under Rule 12b-6, is that
right? Yeah, basically, well, as to the customers under 12b-6, under the competitors under both standing grounds and 12b-6, basically saying that it was that there were so many different hypothetical jumps that needed to be made that there is no way that the court could say that there was any concrete injury. And secondly, even if there were a concrete injury, that both federal and state law require non-speculative, non-conjectural damages.
What are you urging on the court today? I mean, which of the two bases for the dismissal of the complaint are you urging?
Your Honor, I think the analysis on Desert Eagle, which is the customer case, there's only one, obviously, but on the Little case, I think analytically, when you look at it, you have to trod the same path. And you can choose which one you want, whether it's Article 3 standing or 12b-6. It's exactly the same analytical steps. So I would argue.
I mean, even though the district court, with respect to the customers, dismissed on the basis of 12b-6, there's nothing to preclude our deciding it on the basis of 12b-1, is there?
No, there is absolutely nothing to preclude you from doing it under 12b-1.
Indeed, so, I mean, you have no preference one way or the other, you said.
No,
Your
Honor.
You're urging the court to pursue the lack of standing as opposed to the failure to state a claim.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, you're not urging us, if any opinion that we write in here, I mean, you just want to prevail with respect to the judgment. You're not telling us that we can write a stronger opinion basing it on standing as opposed to The failure to state a claim.
Well, Your Honor, I think under the standing, what struck us, particularly on the competitors, is that the standing argument was so strong that this is not something that a federal court should be indulging in, these several seven jumps, and that since standing is a threshold issue for the federal courts, I think that the court could very well go off on the standing ground.
So you're admitting, then, that the customer case is a closer case than the competitor case?
I would say that the competitor case is extraordinary and that it requires seven or eight steps. The customer case is different. The customer case is different in that it tries to employ a concept, a legal and jurisprudential principle, which has never been accepted, just flat out wrong. There is no rule that says you go back in time and look at licenses and, quote, proper licenses. There is no rule like that. It doesn't exist. The district court thought about it and says, hey, you're trying to pigeonhole it into the no license cases, which you don't win on anyway. But it doesn't exist. He says this is not a case where KPMG didn't have a license. So I don't know that I'm comparing the two cases in terms of their strengths. They're different. The first
How would this case be different from your point of view if it were an unlicensed case as opposed to an improperly licensed case?
Your Honor, if it were
How would the damages be different?
Pardon?
How would the injury or the damages be different?
Well, the law, I think, is quite clear that there's no difference in the damages. I mean, the courts have been pretty uniform in saying that not pretty uniform, I'd say, under the restatement third of restitution and the cases from this court and the Tenth Circuit case in Van Zanen and others, all recognize that it's not the question of licensure. I mean, the law in broadest terms, and I think the Ortho Alliance case stands for this proposition, is if you conclude that a contract is illegal, the courts generally don't enforce it. That's what was happening there. It was a bankruptcy case. The question is, are you going to have a business services agreement continue to be enforced? But once it's performed, the court says, did you get substantially what you asked for? And if you did, we're not going to make you pay it back.
So here we're talking about every contract we're talking about has been performed.
It was performed between 1984 and 1999.
So you're essentially saying then that there is no difference in any kind of analysis that we would apply to a improperly licensed scenario and an unlicensed scenario.
I would say this, Your Honor. On the question of damage, qua damage, I don't think there's any difference between unlicensed, properly licensed, and fully licensed because there is no damage. On the question of whether you even look at it, whether you even entertain the entire argument that's being made by the appellants, at least in the unlicensed cases, some courts have said, okay, we'll listen to you as to whether or not an unlicensed person has to give back what they were paid. There's no case that says we will listen to your argument that a person who is licensed and is not, quote, properly licensed, has to give back the money. There's no case that says that. There's not that line of jurisprudence, if it starts here.
Did the state agency have any jurisdiction to go back and somehow sanction the accounting firm for these violations that took place in the past, or they just deal with present licensing today? I mean, if the state licensing agency were to find out that some years back there was an improper license issued, can they sanction the accounting firm today?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that both sides have alluded to different portions of the Texas Act that says for violations of the Texas Act, you can either impose a $1,000 or a $100,000 penalty, depending on what year it occurred. So looking at it analytically from the top, there's two ways of looking at it. First, they could have taken action with respect to the license had it been brought up at the time. Second, they can take actions today with respect to violations of the Act. And there are damages provisions for violations of the Act.
And no action has been
taken? No action's been taken. Not that I'm aware of. And indeed, you know, I want to step back for one moment and ask ourselves about this case, because it's useful to think about it for a moment. The Twombly case said And there was an interesting observation. They said that in today's world, the discovery costs can make a defendant, even in an anemic case, be forced to settle, and that people shouldn't have to spend an enormous amount of effort trying to pursue something that doesn't, where you're really not going to find anything. And you ask yourself, just, is this the poster child for Twombly? I mean, this case is looking at just to pull the documents for 15 years of every client that KPMG had in Texas, every client that they had in Texas. What would be just the cost? Tens of millions of dollars. And on the other side, what damages did all of those clients incur? Has any one of them spent 1 cent because of this? And the answer to that is no. And so you ask, Twombly says at some point motions to dismiss have to look to see whether the claims are so implausible, so conjectural, with so many jumps, that we must say we don't want them in the federal courts and we're going to wash them out before this immense costs are imposed on parties. And that is this case. That is precisely this case. And what they're asking you to do is an intellectual exercise. Every once in a while, you start thinking through things and say, gee, that sounds very facile, very interesting. You say, why has nobody ever thought of that before? Why has nobody ever embraced that theory before? It's because there is no jurisprudence to support it, Your Honor. And if we do, we start along these alternative realities where you can't figure out where we're going. I mean, what is the theory is that KPMG would have been an unlicensed, would have lost its license, okay? What would the 600 accountants have done? Would they have become florists? All but Mr. Hudson probably would be going to, in their alternative world, to PricewaterhouseCoopers and competing with them.
He would have gone back to New York.
Or, Your Honor, they could have opened two-person accounting firms right across the street from Mr. Little, and Mr. Little would be a florist. But this is not the exercise that we should go through here. This is not how the courts impose the damage laws and the laws of causation. So I submit to the court, when the court looks at these issues and tries to examine them, we have to ask ourselves, what did they ask for and what did they get? That's ultimately what the trial court found. They asked for accounting services from a licensed accounting firm. That's what they got. I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Villa. Mr. Kammerer, you've saved some time for a rebuttal.
May it please the court. Mr. Villa answered your question, Judge Jolly, by saying there is no difference with respect to the damages question, unlicensed versus licensed. And that's right. What he's saying is that the lack of a license can never give rise to an actionable difference in value. No court has ever announced that rule. If this court announces that rule, then the next case will be the case of the unlicensed surgeon, the unlicensed lawyer, so on and so forth. It is at least plausible that lack of a license or impropriety in securing a license can give rise to a difference in value. And this is not a case that Twombly speaks to. This is a case with an 89-page complaint drafted carefully with the benefit of deposition testimony of the executive director of the State Board and KPMG's admissions in other litigation before Judge Rosenthal. There is no fishing expedition going on. Also, Mr. Villa made the claim that there has been no case that has addressed whether or not a misrepresentation about an improper license is actionable. There is such a case. It's the Milan case, I believe from the Sixth Circuit, although I might be wrong about the circuit, and it holds that a misrepresentation about an FDA license and an FDA approval, where the license and approval were procured by fraud, would be actionable under the Lanham Act. There is jurisprudence. It's on our side.
And there are allegations of fraud here.
Yes, Your Honor. Indeed, there are more than allegations in this case. We have already, without discovery, documents that show that KPMG submitted to the State Board Mr. Hudson's name in 1986 with a New York bar number. The State Board then circled the numbers, said not a Texas CPA, and KPMG lied to the State Board by saying he was in the process of becoming licensed when, in fact, he did not apply until 1992. We have documents to show that he applied in 1992, and KPMG lied to the State Board, saying he was an out-of-state accountant when he'd been practicing in Texas since 1984. His application was revoked. The point is that the conduct here is egregious. This is not a borderline case, and it is not a case with facts that make it susceptible to the announcement of the kind of novel, special rule of law that KPMG seeks, which is that licensure can never affect the value of services. Finally, with respect to Judge Prado's point about the jurisdiction of the State Board, Texas law is clear that state agencies do not have any special competence in assessing what they would have done in the past. Those are the Texas Austin Chevrolet case and one other case cited in our brief. So with respect to prior actions, primary jurisdiction is inapplicable. I thank the Court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Cameron. If Mr. Villa would like to reply to the Sixth Circuit case, you may do so in a